Siren Radio.
Even Brian Fernandez said, "What were you thinking?" Gabriella, I mean, I know "Here Comes the Chopper to Chop Off Your Head" is a well-worn line from that point of view, but what exactly were you doing in the Amsterdam dungeon, which effectively has you, you know, almost going for a decapitated thing? I mean, you know, what's going on there, Gabriella?
I went to Amsterdam for a few days. You know what? I thought the Amsterdam dungeon at first was going to be... I've never been to it. I haven't been to the London dungeon. And I thought it was going to be like a historical trip. And well, I thought it was going to be like more fun. However, I spent about an hour and a half just scared the entire time. I enjoyed it, but hated it at the same time. That face is before I knew it was coming, that picture.
Yeah, you should clearly have actually broken the whole system down in terms of doing the York dungeon, then the Edinburgh dungeon, then the London dungeon, and then the Amsterdam dungeon. It would have worked on that basis. I believe the same people are actually responsible for the joys of Scarborough SeaWorld as well, also look after the same company. Could be very confusing if your average dolphin gets taken into a dungeon by mistake. Christian, have you ever been to one of the Amsterdam, York, or London, or indeed Edinburgh dungeons?
I vaguely remember going to the York dungeons, I think, when I was very young anyway. So I remember it, well, I just remember it being a bit morbid and dark, I've been wanting to go to the London one anyway for quite some time.
Well, you can do that and you can work through the whole... So, I mean, does this effectively, Gabriella, lead to your next series of stories for the Gibraltar Chronicle reporting on the dungeons of the globe?
You know what? I wouldn't even want to do it because I was so... I enjoyed it, but I was also scared, so I think I'm going to take a break before doing any more dungeons.
That's all right. I mean, we'll give you full support because obviously as a midweek driver, you have superpowers, as we know. Like knowing what the weather is going to be like for Lincoln all the way from Gibraltar, please share with us what fantastic things can we look forward to or not.
Okay, so the weather in Lincoln today is highs of 27 degrees centigrade, lows of 14 degrees centigrade. It will be a sunny and breezy day.
Live from Gibraltar, with or without her faithful friend Frodo, it's time for Gabriella Peralta on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition.
Is Frodo coping with the heat? That's what we need to know. Or is he just a case of he's now decided I can't take it anymore, just peel me a grape?
He probably wants a grape peel for him. He's been okay with it, I think, because it's a bit slightly warmer in Gibraltar. We've got 28, and we go down to the lowest, I think it's 20 in Gibraltar today. He's okay with it. We just don't walk him during the really warm times.
No.
So we usually do it morning and later in the evening to avoid him going out in the sun. He's been a bit more, like, not eating his food as much because I think he's just a bit more tired.
Well, you know, it can be...
He just has to get used to it. Once he gets used to the change of weather, then he's fine. It's just the first couple of weeks.
That makes sense. Are you a sommelier or a wine expert? What are your views on wine, Gabriella?
I'm growing an appreciation for it slowly. So I've conquered white wine.
Have
I
you?
Like it.
All right.
Red wine...
A dry white wine. Sorry, I was going to my whole refuge there.
Red wine, I like the ones that are like, not the heavy ones, the fruity kind of light wine.
But are you bamboozled by the complexities that effectively can be provided when a waiter will come along and say, "Would madam like to see the wine list?"
Yeah, I'm terrible at the wine list. Mm. If they have things that says, you know, sweet or dry, that's usually helpful. But
well,
it's just by names, I'm clueless.
Worry not, Gabriella, because even if you have to sort of depart and can't listen online, but you can actually access this via the podcast, Joe Wadsack, wine expert, will be showing you. Don't have to worry about things like that. You even don't have to worry about taking a screw top bottle of wine to a social event, because there are many people that say, oh no, not a screw top. I mean, how often have you been faced with that challenge, Christian? Is it cork? Is it screw top? I'll go screw top. It's okay. You can breathe. That's the things there. He will deconstruct the whole sequence in the second hour of the program. We've also got psychologist Linda Papadopoulos talking about Love Island. Yeah, I know. and how it may be setting up unrealistic expectations. No, really, astonishingly. Do you get that in Gibraltar, or is actually Gibraltar just a love peninsula? Have you?
Of course we get ITV. We've all been watching it.
We are. So, I mean, is this to the extent of addiction? Or is it a case? Because I think it's fair to say one of our Midweek Drive debut folk last night, Kirsty, I thought there was a definite addiction there.
Oh, yeah. Know,
it was quite clear. Yeah. I mean, I didn't want to say anything on air, but I thought, whoa, you know, really.
I've been getting into it a bit. Though,
really?
Yeah.
Is it the kind of the thing after the World Cup you think, I must check out a Love Island final?
It's because the World Cup finishes at 9 o'clock, doesn't it? And then straight on afterwards, one of my housemates watches it all the time. Yeah. So,
oh well.
And she has to put up with the football. We have to put up with Love Island. So I've been getting into it a bit.
Danny Dyer, which one? Never mind. So what is it that appeals from your own point of view, Gabrielle? Or is it just a case of, no, you watch it from the perspective of a cultural observer?
I just think it's easy television to watch, and I only got into it last year because all my friends were watching it, and they made like this chat group of everyone like commenting on it, so I didn't want to feel left out, so I started watching it and I started enjoying it.
See, peer
so
pressure.
I think it's just that, because you talk about it to your friends, so if you don't watch it, you kind of feel a bit out of the loop.
Peer pressure.
So I like watching it for that.
Yeah. Well, that's. I mean, you can work your way through that process. Has it got much longer to run, or is it another couple of weeks or so? Does it wrap up?
It goes on for about another 6 weeks.
Six weeks.
I think, yeah.
Fine.
Oh, it might be another 2 weeks. I can't remember.
Well.
One or the other.
I'd say get yourself to the Great Yorkshire Show. Don't go to the real level. I know, who knows what will be happening there. Gabrielle, amazing. We've gone from potential decapitation in Amsterdam. I know, it's all right, don't worry, we haven't lost her. The state of play of Frodo in the heat, wine tasting, and indeed Love Island. I feel that's a packed way to actually launch the programme. Have you had a reasonably interesting link with us this morning?
Yes, I have, thank you.
This is marvellous. Any questions you'd like to put to Stephanie Romaszewski about sleep?
Sleep? Is it more about like how we sleep, or is it about dreams as well?
Actually, we haven't really pursued the dreams. It's been mostly a case of getting sleep with her from that point of view. So either of those lines will work. That'll be fine. We'll hold fire on that little question. Is it more about sleep or the dreams? Will you be back again with us?
Yeah.
I'm saying possibly next week. We may be at the Great Yorkshire Show on Thursday as well, so it may well be a fortnight before we speak again, Gabriella. But either way, can we promise the listener that you will be back?
Yeah, of course I will be back.
Even the weathermen say they'll be safe.
In so many ways, the perfect theme for Stephanie Romaszewski. You bring the summer, whether you're in the winter or whatever season you happen to be in. Isn't that right, Stephanie Romaszewski? You bring the summer. Yay!
Oh, I hope so.
Very true. From the very first time we did a phone link with your good self, we thought, yes, this is a wonderful soul and ideal midweek drivette, our correspondent extraordinaire. Stephanie, welcome back. It's been quite a gap since we last spoke about Steve. In fact, we've been almost
in hibernation. How's your summer going?
How's the summer gone? We're steady. I think we've still got a few more weeks as yet. Somebody sent me an email saying, could we actually do a feature on an autumn tour? I said, autumn! Exclamation mark three times. We haven't even sort of worked our way through the summer as yet. No, it's all very good. And as I say, next week we're hopefully off to the Great Yorkshire Show, so it all connects wondrously. Phil then, so exhausted was he in Los Angeles by celebrating the joys of Independence Day. He's asleep, as you'd expect, really. It is midnight. Exactly. But Christian Arkabowicz is with us in the studio again. Christian, since you first spoke to Stephanie, have you actually consciously adjusted your sleeping patterns and so on? Has it helped?
I have. When I first spoke to you, Stephanie, you recommended not changing drastically, but just changing slightly my routine before I go to sleep. So brushing my teeth an hour or two before going to sleep and then just getting to bed, just reading or whatever and just relaxing myself and then slowly going to sleep. And it's worked, I have to admit. I mean, like, I'm up this morning from doing the routine that I've been sort of getting myself into, and I'm not really much of a morning person, but it's definitely helped anyway.
Oh, that's really good.
So thank you.
You're most welcome. I mean, the fact that you're doing this in the summer as well is really good, because it's much easier to regulate your routine right now when we've got such good light in the mornings, and it will help you for when the winter comes around if you can keep this routine up now.
Yeah.
Splendid. As I pointed out yesterday when we were speaking to the show director for the Great Yorkshire Show, and I mentioned to Christian that we'd be departing from Lincoln at 5:30 a.m. on Tuesday, he did actually pay a little bit for that.
Yeah, that might be a bit too early.
we'll just have to wait and see. That's the important thing. Quick question for you, Stephanie, from Gabriella Peralta in Gibraltar. And she was saying, we've talked about sleep. Do you ever cross over into dreams and aspects relating to dreams as well? I'm not necessarily talking about interpretation, but the whole essence of dream reading and so on.
Not particularly, mainly just because there's so many theories out there. Mm. But obviously, when you're going through a stressful time, we do tend to remember our dreams more. But it's usually because we're so preoccupied with this stress that it actually interferes with our sleep architecture. So our sleep architecture being that the lovely stages that we go through that provide us with all the restorative processes and everything we need every day. But when you're feeling stressed, it's like having an external influence, like light or noise, but it's coming from internally, and it can actually disrupt your rhythms. And of course, if it's disrupting it, then it can potentially disrupt your REM state, which is where you do the most of your dreaming. And you'll know if you're disrupted because you end up remembering your dreams in the morning. So you might have more of a inclination to say that you've had quite bad, stressful dreams, but really it's just the fact that you've been remembering them, which means we know that your sleep has been interfered with and that we need to work a little bit on your sleep. Whereas most of the time when you're feeling quite healthy and you've got good sleep and you haven't got lots of environmental factors affecting you and stress, then you will probably not remember your dreams as much. So that's kind of as far as I tend to go with the whole dream thing.
It was often a staple of science fiction shows, indeed, sort of The Prisoner and so on, that you can actually read people's dreams, that you reach a stage where you can connect people together, you can work through that. Is that just still in the department of, well, that's very highfalutin, or can you somehow look at the algorithms and so on and say, that's what they're talking about?
Yeah, well, in a nutshell, probably we can do a lot more than we realise. Mm. I think we just need the tools to do it. We can do things like we can tell what people are dreaming about based on sort of talking to them before they go to sleep and looking at their brain activity when they're asleep, potentially waking them up in certain areas of their sleep and talking to them again. So we can manipulate our dreams and we can even control them. So we know that a lot of people practice lucid dreaming, and people really get into this. And lucid dreaming is where you can actually control your dreams to a degree. But the problem is, to do that, often you have to sleep deprive yourself a little bit, or at least get yourself to the edge of sleep and then bring yourself back out of it. So it's been said that it's very good to bring up your most creative thoughts and things like that. Mm. But actually, in terms of regular healthy sleep, it's not that great for you to try to do more with your dreaming. You kind of don't really want to. It's okay to remember your dreams every now and again, and they're really interesting sometimes, but you need to take that with a bit of a pinch of salt and just try to regulate your sleep a bit better so that you don't remember your dreams, because that means you're getting the restorative processes that you so desperately need every night.
I've always wondered about that lucid dreaming. When you do it, does it tire you out? Like, would you wake up more tired in the morning because your brain isn't basically asleep?
You've been exhausting yourself at sleep.
Yeah,
the reason that you would be tired is because if you're remembering your dreams, then that stage of sleep is being interrupted. So if you're vividly remembering it, then yes, you will be more knackered. You know when you have like a really big dream and you wake up in the morning and you can remember every detail and you're exhausted? It feels like you've been running a marathon all night and not actually sleeping, when in actual fact it was probably only for, say, 2 minutes or even less. But because your REM sleep is interrupted and your sleep doesn't like that, it wants to go through the cycles as it knows best. It doesn't want to suddenly be interrupted. You're going to be a lot more exhausted in the morning than if you weren't interrupted through those cycles.
See, these are the kind of things which just are essential in all sorts of ways, particularly when you're worried about England's progress against Sweden in the World Cup final. Has it been impacting at all, Stephanie? Because I can see sort of sleep patterns up and down the country could have been changed from that whole perspective.
I think if you had a look right now, then yeah, probably. Especially when we do something as a society, or, you know, there's a lot of people with the same kind of vibes going on, I definitely think that you would find that people are a bit more anxious at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stephanie, are you following England? Is it a case of, well, I have to step aside from that? Is it a case of I can't cope with Poland's ejection whatsoever? What's the sort of life in the Romoszewski household been like?
I definitely think that I want England to win, of course.
Yeah,
I do.
Excellent.
But I think I take it with a bit of a pinch of salt. Mm. I'm not a massive football fan, but yes, I want England to win.
Yeah. Well, there we are. That's an important side of things. Yeah. And how's the weather in the joys of Exeter Land?
Oh, well, it's beautiful, but I keep getting caught in these random torrential rains. So I go outside and it's beautifully hot, 25 degrees, and then suddenly torrential rain.
Yeah, you see, we're going to have to move you to Lincoln, clearly. That's the key thing.
Yeah.
East Coast on that, baby. Maybe a franchise could be sort of opened up on that, baby. Don't forget sleepyheadclinic.co.uk, the best place to go to for further details and connections, Stephanie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Marvelous.
There's a blog on there.
That's a whole heap of other things from that perspective. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
As usual, yes, I have.
Of course, there is that wonderful meta-narrative of saying, has this all just been a dream, Stephanie? You know, are we actually dreaming this connection? You know,
maybe.
We're actually here, three astral travellers, four, if you include the listener, effectively making that contact through the mysteries of space and time and so on. Anyway, assuming we can ponder that, will you be back again with us in the very near future?
Yes, of course I will.
Just a little bit sad.
I was feeling so empty
until you came back. Until you came. We'll be right back.
Of course, if you say something is sick these days, it's really totally cool, man, which is why I wouldn't use the term, even if I'm going to see Sicario. Sorry, I couldn't resist it, Richard Fitzwilliams. Good morning, how are you?
Oh, I'm certainly well. Enjoyed a visit to Henley yesterday, which is always very, very colourful, the rowing regatta.
And was it jolly boating weather?
It certainly was.
Marvellous. 27 degrees centigrade here in the joys of Lincoln for Siren Radio, Lincoln's first community radio station, and probably equally as high in London. Although it has been said, Richard, that actually when it gets to these kind of conditions, being in the capital of London as you currently are, not necessarily the most pleasant of experiences.
Well, it depends where you are, and it depends, obviously, if you're stuck in some tube or other. I mean, obviously not, but then that would apply absolutely anywhere. But if, in fact, you're heading to see the prime of Miss Jean Brodie,
Well, let's not go to the creme de la creme yet, Richard. We will talk about that in a few moments. But before then, Christian Arkabowicz, did you see Sicario 1?
Yeah, I watched it the other night, actually.
So allowing for the fact that Sicario 2 director Stefano Sollima has already ruled himself out for the third movie, I sense a franchise here.
You sense correctly.
Will Sicario : Day of the Soldado be appearing on your must-watch viewing in the near future?
I will be, yeah. I'll definitely be making a point to watch it.
Well, that's before your review, Richard, so clearly the audience is out there for Sicario : Day of the Soldado. But what do you say, sir?
Well, I have to say that Sicario 1, a remarkable film indeed. You could argue Emily Blunt was given over much to do, which involved heroics. But having said that, that opening packed a punch that I'm still reeling from. It really was very well done. And Denis Villeneuve was the director. And I wish he'd been the director here, because obviously terrorism with people smuggling, with the activities of the drug cartels, you've got these are among the most important threats facing us and leaving a tide of human misery in their wake. So this is a movie that depicts the links between them. Terrorists are being smuggled in, and there's a bomb outrage in Kansas, and this is by the drug cartels, and they're linked with people smugglers, and Mexico, and it's certainly quite often entertaining. The main appeal of this movie is in some exciting action sequences. And visually, yes, I mean, there's one particular shot filmed, obviously, from held in a helicopter, and underneath, so to speak, as you look down on the terrain, an airliner passes. That's poetic. So the bits are quite good. But we continue to follow the Mexican undercover operative Alejandro Gillick, played by Benicio del Toro, who conducts a one-man campaign against the cartels after the murder of his daughter. You remember that in the first Sicario. And he works with CIA agent Matt Graver, played by Josh Brolin, who has orders from the Secretary of Defense, played by Matthew Modine, to escalate the war into a dirty war. And the kidnapping of a cartel's boss's daughter, Isabella, played by Isabella Mona, is pivotal to this plan. Now, Stefano Sollima, frankly, I mean, there are several problems with this movie. Firstly, the subject is a pretty shady business anyway, but don't film too much in dark environments. There's so much of this movie is in the dark, it's sometimes quite difficult to know who's saying what and who's doing what. So a confusing plot is made more confusing, and the dialogue is also a bit difficult to hear occasionally. People chew bubble gum and talk.
But Richard, it's Benicio del Toro. He always mumbles.
I know, but the trouble is that you want a script. He's been some very, very good stuff from Traffic onwards, and the facts are that if you've got an unsubtle script. I mean, the problem with this movie, let's be frank, you mentioned it yourself, sequels, the franchise, and the fact that, quite frankly, this is very anticlimactic at the end. The purpose of the end of this movie, I hate to be rather damning, is simply to provide material for the next one. And yes, I mean, there's some extremely impressive filmed fight sequences, swirling clouds of dust, or at night, I mean, as well, a lot, as I say, of this movie is at night, which, will, you know, that'll be popular, and its parts are quite exciting, but the cast really don't need much more beyond physicality, and they ought to, because the movie deals with matters that are indeed pressing and serious, and issues of our time which go beyond the gung-ho stuff that frankly, it's the only reason to see this.
Last evening, we were listening to Chilapack Hollywood Hour, the weekly podcast produced by Phil Leonis and Dean Hagland. And Phil was very, very scathing in his views of Kingsman 2, which he said was not a patch on the original Kingsman and was very disappointing, etc. Is Sicario 2 as challenging? Is it as much of a drop-off as Kingsman 2, Golden Circle, was from Kingsman 1?
No, I wouldn't compare them. I mean, I obviously you've frequently got follow-ups that aren't as good as the original, and I wasn't wild about Kingsman 1 because I thought the end of it rather ruined it, but it was a very good idea. I thought Kingsman 2 was rubbish, yes. This isn't rubbish. It's simply a movie that doesn't fulfill its potential. And
so rubbish, but not sick.
You're keen on that pun, Alex. It's not one of your best.
Richard, I just feel it's totes amazeballs every time you give a sick review. Sorry, I'm getting down with the July folk here. Never mind.
I was wondering, in the first film, there was a part, I don't know, it was about maybe 15 minutes long or something, where they have a convoy going into Juarez or something like that, and there's this tension that builds up, and it builds and builds and builds to a 5-second gun shootout or something right at the end.
We must be careful of spoilers.
Just that building tension. Is there anything like that in the second film as well? Because that's what I enjoyed probably the most from the first.
The answer is frankly not really. The first is directed by someone who, I remember, Arrival. I mean, Denis Villeneuve is very, very good at the director, and the first movie reflected that. Second, I mean, it's so average, and my point, of course, is that, you know, it is dealing with really serious threats and issues that
Well, thank heavens, so Richard, we've got Ant-Man and the Wasp, and, of course, Mission Impossible 6 or 7 to look forward to.
And I'm looking forward to Mission Impossible because the last one was exceptionally good.
That was Rogue Nation, of course.
It was, and it also was extraordinary that they built a mock-up of a street in Soho, up a windmill street, for one of a part of it, where there was some nefarious goings on, and I happened to see it in the cinema and walked out of the cinema
into the very same street. Is it reality?
One asks oneself, indeed, it's the bookshop.
In 1959, a free-spirited widow, Florence Green, risked everything to open a bookshop in a conservative East Anglian coastal town.
Indeed, yes, and I have to say, I mean, this movie could have done with a few murders, it really could have. I mean, it's quite a sensitive series of character studies because it's got a top-rate cast. I mean, she's very keen. Emily Mortimer plays Florence Green. She's a war widow. She's very keen on books. She opens the bookshop, and we have little character studies of the various individuals in the very, very English village in the 1950s. I mean, obviously, this again is a movie that uses picture postcarding, and so many of them do. There are, however, some good performances. Edmund Brundish, played by Bill Nye, is a recluse who orders books from her, and then she visits him, and a certain tendress develops between them. And there's also a malicious character, Violet Gamut, played by Patricia Clarkson, rather well, wife of a rather doddery general who has a nephew in Parliament who, she basically, he's assisting her in trying to turn this building into an arts centre, so she conducts a war against Florence, who wants to stay and intends to stay. There are all sorts of setups. All of this is I mean, this is very much the, it's very localized. It's told in flashback by a narrator who happens, I did not notice, it's quite interesting, is Julie Christie. It's very English, it's very stereotyped. Some of the characterizations are quite sensitive. Quite honestly, the cast could do this with their eyes closed, and Isabel Coixet directs, but without that much flair. It's based on Penelope Fitzgerald's novel. Depending on whether or not.
Yes or no, Richard. That's very unlike your good self. That's almost sitting on the fence.
Sitting on the fence. Well, I mean, the thing is that there isn't that much that happens in this movie. It's not terribly convincing. It's quite sweet. And some of the acting is rather good. But having said that, as I say, it does need a couple of murders to really liven it up. At least I felt so.
I think you've been converted by Sicario 2. That's what's the trouble, you see. And you want this kind of drug cartel in the bookshop.
Yes, I think that actually would have been a very, very advantageous development, because you need more meat, more dramatic meat than this offers.
Or possibly a vegan alternative. Just a thought there.
Any alternative, quite frankly. But I mean, it is quite endearing in its way.
Are you suggesting Bill Nighy might have just phoned in his performance?
He's a very, very good actor, and never better than in Skylight. I remember the David Hare play. I mean, honestly, he's... Somebody always...
Has he banked the cheque for this one, is what I'm saying? Has he banked
the cheque? Banked the cheque, playing someone who was terribly, terribly sensitive, never went out of his aristocratic... He's aristocratic, he never goes out of his home, he's reclusive, but does he or does he not to try and help save the bookshop? And what happens? I mean, frankly, you could see some of this plot. It creaks dreadfully. You could see some of this miles off.
Well, it is a co-production between Spain and Britain and a variety
of
areas.
Yes, I noticed, and it's won a lot of awards in Spain, which is very curious, as though I would suggest that the fact that there's Spanish money in it would make a difference.
Clearly. Will you be checking out the bookshop, Christian?
After that review,
unlikely,
I may give it a miss.
Unlikely.
Yeah.
The power of Richard Fitzwilliams, possibly, you may not. It's not the creme de la creme, and we just can't get away from this 1969 movie, which had Gene, and a variety of other things. The prime of Miss Gene Brody is what I'm referring to, Christian, just in case I wanted to clarify that. Based on the novel by Muriel Spark, and it's back on the London stage, Richard.
Yes, it most certainly is, and I have to say this is really a wonderful experience. I mean, Leo Williams, who'd recently had a triumph playing, I saw her play Mary Stuart, but in Mary Stuart by Schiller, but in fact she, as you know, alternates the roles depending on the spin of a coin with Juliet Stevenson, and she was absolutely excellent. And frankly, it's such a touching play, and based, as you say, on the novel by Muriel Spark set in 1930s Edinburgh about the teacher at Marcia Blaine School, a conservative school, but Miss Brodie encourages her girls, her crème de la crème, since she's in her prime, to love beauty and romance and lifts their spirits, and the conservative ethos of the school is against her, but on the other hand, there are two teachers who lust after her. One, the music teacher, Mr. Lowther, the other, the art master, Teddy Lloyd. And but her set are very special girls, and it's very interesting that you're really... It's a study of someone who does indeed bring so much to her lessons and the relationships with the individual girls, but it's also the study of a deeply deluded individual who's not only a fondness for fascism, but also, quite frankly, almost nothing she does, as you see that the movie the play develops, is actually... has many links to reality. And what fascinated me was Leo Williams is such a touching performance. No spoilers again, but this is a very, very different take on it from the film, and it has some twists at the end. It's told in flashback by Sandy, played by Rona Morrison, a marvellous, marvellous performance. Such a presence. Sandy is the one of Miss Brodie's set who she rather underestimates, and it's fascinating to follow how and what happens, and also very, very, it's touching, it's atmospheric. Sandy is talking to a journalist just before she goes into a convent to take the veil, and thinking back on Miss Brodie and how she was influenced. She's just published a novel, Who Was the Major Influence on It? So the Dunmar really, really has scored an excellent collection of the others in the supporting cast. Sylvester Latuzel's Miss Mackay is far more sympathetic and a good deal less malign than Celia Johnson was as sexually repressed and rather monstrous character in the 1960s film, and I have to say Johnson makes much more impact. But you've got Angus Wright, excellent, as the rather lackluster Mr. Lowther, and Edward McKeon, fine as of Teddy Lloyd, one-armed, which is a touch, of course, because he's lost in the war, and the girls are indeed the creme de la creme, particularly Rona Morrison, as I say, as Sandy, a star born here, in, I thought, and Leah Williams, marvellous as the glorious and also gloriously impractical and deluded Miss Brodie. But there's a lot in this production that's very touching.
It's the third stage incarnation you've seen, Richard. I'm sensing that the prime of Miss Dream Brodie is pretty much your theatrical equivalent of Lawrence of Arabia. Is that a fair comment?
Well, it's certainly one that I'm extremely fond of. Yes, I saw Patricia Hodge play Miss Brodie as mainly as a malign fascist. It was Geraldine McKeown who did the television series that was Miss Brodie. Of course, Maggie Smith, who I...
Clearly, Richard, you need to set up a series of appreciation societies for the prime of Miss Jean Brodie and have the Brodies working through this process. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie, read the book, or anything else, Christian. Does it appeal to yourself? I think it's okay. I can't quite eulogise in the same way Richard would actually say about it. I'd probably give it 5.5 to 6 out of 10.
You haven't seen the play, have you?
No, I'm talking about the movie there.
Oh, goodness, that's a low score. you put in a little dig there that I was not expecting.
It's just, what? Christian.
No, I have heard of the film. I didn't realise there was a book. I just heard of the film. But it didn't really appeal to me in a sense. It's
an interesting one. I personally prefer Daisy Pulls It Off, which is Jolly Hockey Sticks and completely different line of things. Let us move on, Richard, very briefly to Royal Finances, because you're at the St. James's Palace Briefling, I believe.
Indeed, yes, and I have to say that the Royals, in my view, are excellent value for money. But what you've got at the moment are two sets of Royal Finances. You've firstly got the 15% of the sovereign support grant, which is paid to the Queen. Most of it goes on either royal palaces or it goes on staff costs, also royal travel, which brings in a lot for British business. This dates back to 1760, where George III, when heavily in debt, unwisely surrendered the income from the crown lands for exchange for a civil list. And in 2012, the sovereign support grant replaced the civil list. And what happened subsequently was also a decision to, for 10 years, to add another 10% of the crown lands, that's bringing $320 million a year profit. So they're certainly doing exceptionally well as investments. Another, for 10 years, £369 million of refurbishment of Buckingham Palace. Absolutely essential it's done, because obviously it is...
Well, let's hope they do as successful a job as they're currently doing with Big Ben, not according to various other tourists who are very depressed that they can't see Big Ben.
There's no question that if you consider the value for money, 69 people per person, excluding security, the number, and also think of the, yes, it's a lot of money for Buckingham Palace. It hasn't been done since the 1940s in many cases, in fact, with wiring, say, and generators and boilers and so forth. But Buckingham Palace is known throughout the world as a symbol of our monarchy.
And we know that Her Majesty the Queen is somewhat frugal, unlike her son. But never mind, that's another line entirely.
Well, the Clarence House accounts were interesting. The Prince's Trust has always been a template for helping the disadvantaged young, 870,000 last year, and he's put his 16 core charities in three groups now, and he gets over 20 million from a 1337 arrangement by the Duchy of Cornwall, provides an income for the eldest son of the monarch, which works well. It may be a rather curious or archaic way of paying the prince and his family. The one thing we don't get is the breakdown of how much the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge and
I'm sure it'll happen. Maybe they should actually go off to Love Island and actually take part in there. That would increase the popularity
hugely.
I must
watch that so that I could comment.
No, don't, Richard. Honestly, I'd say just step away from the whole thing. Sicario 2, colon, Soldado, mixed. The bookshop, definitely thumbs down from Richard, I sense.
Well, I mean, it's not so much thumbs down.
Couldn't even raise the energy to give a thumb up or down.
That is a pretty accurate thing. You sit on the fence thinking of a film like that and you fall asleep.
Prime of Miss Jean Brodie.
The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie was absolutely
definitely thumbs up at the Donmar.
Oh, well, but the Donmar produces so much that remember Dangerous Liaisons there. I mean, it really, really is worth following what's on show there.
Precisely.
I may also make the point that it's David Hanawa who's adapted the Muriel Spark novel, and he did Blackbird, which starred Roger Allam and Jodie May. I thought an extraordinary play. This was about a girl who'd been abused and yet still had this rather horrendous link with her abuser. Allam is a superb actor. He really was very, very fine as well. I've seen him as Macbeth and also as Billy Brandt.
Christian, last two questions for Richard, please.
Talking about the going back to the theatre productions and the plays and stuff like that. I recently went to go see the Cursed Child, the Harry Potter one, and I was just wondering that's one of the main ones I've seen. I haven't really sort of seen anything else sort of theatre wise production. What would you recommend for someone who's
a novice?
Yeah, a novice.
Where should he actually go, Chris? Where should Christian actually go for his first theatrical trip after The Cursed Child, Richard?
Well, I mean, of course, if he could get a ticket for Hamilton, that would be one suggestion, but it's very difficult. I would suggest a musical experience. The West End is made up of musicals. There's so many, it's hard to choose. I would say that if you're looking for drama, I mean, there's one called Consent at the Harold Pinter Theatre, which sounds rather interesting.
We'll leave it there, Richard. You can come back with a few other bits and pieces shortly, but have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning?
Yes, I have, certainly.
And you'll be back with us sometime next week, possibly on Thursday, if we're not at the Great Yorkshire Show for all 3 days. It's all very confusing.
A Thursday actually would still be ideal.
When I was a boy, I had a dream all about the things I'd like to be. Soon as I was in my bed, music played inside my head. When I was a boy, I had a dream. When I was a boy, I learned to play. Far into the night and drift away. Don't wanna work on the milk or the bread. Just wanna play my guitar instead. When I was a boy, I had a dream. And rain.